Hello and welcome to the Majlis Podcast Radio Free of the Liberties Current Affairs Talk Show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free of the Liberties Media Manager here in Washington, D.C. 10 states have returned to Tajikistan's restive autonomous Gorno-Badakhshan region. The latest round of tensions sparked over the weekend after a heavy hand response by the security forces against protesters demanding the resignation of regional authorities over the lack of investigation into the 2021 killing of a local activist in police custody. Telecommunication has been immediately cut off and access to this remote region has been difficult and restricted. On the top of that, authorities are also trying to censor any information about the region and this tension, including by harassing local journalists of international organizations. Therefore, we do not have a reliable flow of updated news and analysis as to what's going on in the region as we speak, but what became clear is that the latest tension has been the deadliest in recent months and years. In this episode of the Majlis podcast, we have invited the panel of experts whom we believe are the most qualified speakers in this issue, and we will try to assess what's going on as we speak, what happened, and what might come next. And in the long term, what does the growing militarization of this tension tell us about the direction of this tension in months and years ahead, and what can be done about it? To discuss all this, I'm joined by Bakhtiyor Safarov, the director of Central Asia Consulting, who is originally from Tajikistan's autonomous Badakhshan region, Salimjan Ayubov, the director of Radio Free Prepared Liberties Tajik Service, locally known as Radio Azadi, who is also from Tajikistan, and Bruce Panier, long-term Central Asia specialist and the author of Radio Free Prepared Liberties Central Asia in Focus newsletter. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us in this important conversation. So I know we are taping this podcast on Thursday at 10 p.m. local time. Events will change by the time the podcast will hit the internet, but let's start with what we know so far. Bakhtiyor, let me start with you. So what is going on? What your source are telling you, what you are hearing from your own relatives, your friends in the region?
Thank you very much, Mohammed. Thank you very much, panelists. And I want to thank you for your interest. And I want to greet your listeners as well. And I am one of them. I can go to sleep at Saturday nights before not listening to your podcast. So thank you very much for doing that. So in terms of the situation in Khorog and in Gabal, what we're witnessing, this is a continuation of what started a long time ago, to be exact, around 1992. So since then, the people of Badakhshan has been executed. As you know, we had documents of almost a genocide, and we were just part of the, most of the Badakhshani people were part of the democratic movements that they started in the early 19s, and most of them are still committed. Like my father was a part of the Democratic Party movement, so, and he's been, you know, one of the pro-independent movement participants. He was a doctor, graduate from Ukraine, so he was one of those guys that was really independent and very secular person to begin with. And then in 1992, we were blamed with, you know, that these are like terrorists, and like, you know, with this narrative, we got pushed out. A lot of people, along with other Tajik people who were part of the democratic movements, they were killed or either jailed, and it's been going on since then. So I would describe this as a continuation of repression of freedom of speech, freedom of movement, and any freedoms you can ever imagine. And the last one, just the one, the recent one, started in May 14th. I came to my office, opened the internet, and I saw the ad saying there's going to be a big gathering in Khorog. Oh, I thought, oh, it's just recent gathering. And I remembered that's in Tajikistan. So I said, well, that's not going to end well. So I took a break, sit a little bit, and I said, I have to do something. So then I posted on Twitter, and I got a lot of retweets and likes. And I knew at that time that's not only me concerned, a lot of people are concerned about this. And after that, you know, the people, May 16th, they had some, you know, concerns they want to share. They want to proceed to the center square, Ismail Somoni Square in Khorog, but they got stopped in the way to go into square. even one person got killed. So it's Zamir Nazarshoev. I was just talking to his neighbor. He just literally grew up and he's in front. He was just walking. We don't know even he was going to the protest. He was just walking on the road and they just sniper hits them. I don't know if it's a sniper. It needs to be investigated. But the guy, apparently, he was just bystander at this point. That's what I heard from. So he gets killed. So instead of investigating the whole situation as any other governments do, they just pull and trigger the crisis more. So for this unarmed people, I just think it's a very covert act. They send more people. They ask for more help from Tajikistan, which angers the people in Rushon and other part of the Gabao. And they start just blocking the road because they are afraid of for the faith of other people. And they waited on May 17th overnight, the military convoy at one of the border guards in Rushon. And in the morning, early in the morning, I was like 12 o'clock DC time. And I saw that they started this operation. They just started shooting people deliberately. They used at least two helicopters. Yeah. Snipers were shooting from the helicopters. Mm-hmm. And it's literally, now people will get reports, it's really turning into Bucha of Tajikistan. Mm-hmm. It's not only that, there were wounded people laying on the ground. They didn't let people to go and take them to the hospital for the to treat the wounds. Mm. So these some of the people just died on the streets.
Thank you very much for all the historical background you also presented on this about the source of this issue and connecting it nicely to what has been happening over the past few days. And obviously we are going to talk about this tension and on the historical background definitely. But before that, Salim John, because we lack reliable information as to what is going on in this region, and given the region is remote, internet is cut off, and then, you know, lots of concern about what is really going on. What you are hearing, Salim John, from your own reporters and sources in the region, and I know your reporters have been harassed just because they are trying to report about this issue. So tell us, please, about what is your update? What's the latest you know about this?
Thank you, Muhammad. Hi, everyone. You described the current situation very well. So I can share the most recent information that my brave colleagues have obtained and compiled bit by bit from many sources, double-checked every information and verified and clarified. So here is the latest news today. The population of the Rushan region of Gbao was allowed to pick up the corpses of those who were killed yesterday during either clashes or, as Bakhtiar mentioned, simple killings of the people who tried to close the main road between Dushanbe and Khorug. Rushan district is in between of Dushanbe and Khorug. In terms of entering Khorug, you should go through Rushan region and Vomar and other villages. So the main road and the only road. So the residents of Rushan tried to block the road, not allowing new forces, new armor, new militaries to enter to the region. So at the beginning, it was, let's say, peacefully, but then we do not know so far who started. The officials, some of officials are saying that the those people who blocked the road were armed. But many witnesses among locals are denying that. However, so yesterday there was clashes between two sides. But today, yeah, today in general, the population received 21 corpses. This information is verified from many sources, witnesses and relatives. And today was a funeral day for the people of Vomar. And as several witnesses and relatives of the victims told us that some of the victims had marks of torture on their bodies, and several corpses were thrown out at the stadium of the Derzut village, and all of them were nude, without dresses. So that's the total death toll since the start of the latest protests is up to 30.
Turkey.
But there are the cases that we have not been able to verify, and probably the number of deaths is higher than 30, but we are sure about those 30. But again, it's hard to check, and officials are stick to 9 killed and 24 wounded. But today they stated the same, but the only change in the numbers is of the Chinese. Now the authorities are saying that 114 local residents of Gbao are in custody, while they stated yesterday the number was 70. So today, May 19, was a quiet day, as I said, the funeral day and mourning day, and there was no shooting, although helicopters circled in the sky of the region, and the relative stability was also noted today by the Deputy Minister of Internal Affairs of Tajikistan, Abdurrahman Alamshozoda, who is in the region now, and he spoke at the meeting of local activists in Khorug, and the meeting was attended mostly by government officials, and said that the local leader Mamat Bokirov and his supporters should surrender to the authorities, and if they do this, the punishment will be lighter or smaller, as he put. And he accused him and others, as he said, of organized crime groups, of defiance and destabilization of the situation in the region. It is believed that these groups, under the leadership of Mamat Bokir, who galvanizing the situation in the region. But we know that the only thing that they demand, the resignation of the local leaders and the full investigation into the death of Gulbuddin Ziyobekov, who was killed during an arrest attempt on November 25 of last year.
Selimjan, I know there's a lot to talk about, and also you already provided us lots of information that I wanted to unpack some of them. So we are saying now confirmed reports of casualties stands on 30. So what do we know, Selimjan, in terms of the circumstances of the death? You said that there were, you know, signs of torture in their bodies, but how to visualize how those guys got killed?
According to the official version, a group of 200 armed people attacked the government forces. And today, just some minutes ago, the state news agency Khobar published another statement provided by security forces, and telling that they confiscated a lot of weapons. However, yesterday they were talking about weapons, but not in detail, just saying that Molotov cocktail. So we in the Tajik service and our experts and some sources in Dushanbe imagining that so several new forces or on military cars, just imagine that those cars full of soldiers and moving towards Khorug. And of course, people in Rushon decided to block the road. And actually, the Deputy Interior Ministry today said the road is still blocked. We don't know if it's true or not. But we heard from a soldier who was wounded in this situation and transported to Kulob, and he's right now he's in Dushanbe Military Hospital, but yesterday he was in Kulob Central Hospital. And he told our journalists that it was a real clash between those who blocked the road and military forces, and they had no way just to call new forces to support, and the support came from the sky. So several helicopters came to the scene and started shooting from helicopters, shooting the people who were blocking the road. So again, it's hard, it's difficult. We did not publish this piece of information because we are still working on it, and we wanted to reconstruct the timeline of the events and how it happened. And about those who marked by torture signs, the locals are telling us that when it started yesterday at 7 morning and close to the midday, people dispersed, probably because there was a lot of shooting. And some bodies, as Bakhtiar also mentioned and compared it to Bucha, some corpses laid down on the road. And then militaries entered house by house search and tried to find out those who either protested or either used arm against the government forces. And they rounded up a lot of young men and brought them to the local border outpost. And then today the officials allowed the local residents to collect bodies who laid on the streets. And also they told them, go to the Dirzut Stadium and you will find some more corpses there, you know.
Even listening to these horrific stories are so painful. Yeah, authorities on one hand saying that, you know, there was a clash. I don't even know how to imagine this clash. You know, we keep saying clash. I mean, what kind of clash we are talking really about? You know, government, obviously they have helicopters, guns and tanks and all these equipments, you know. What are the means through which the local protesters have been reacting to that? And if there was a clash, you know, it looks like all of those 30 people that we are talking about are the ones who are killed are protesters, not soldiers. If there were clash, how to explain the situation? So it is.
You know, just one point that 8 members of military are wounded and 1 officer killed during this event. And we know the name of the officer, and we know from which part of the country he was, and yesterday it was his funeral. And we also, our journalists talked to those who wounded, at least to 2 of them. The second one denied everything and just rejected to talk to us. So it's possible that some of the protesters were armed. We don't know, you know, and maybe it was a kind of provocation by militaries themselves to kill and to wound some people. But compared, as you said, if 21 of the local residents killed and 1 military officer and killed and 8 of them wounded. So, of course, the numbers are telling us that. So it was not full-scale clash, but it was something else, you know.
So, Bruce, also, obviously, as a journalist standing on the neutral ground here, trying to reflect all the accounts that are coming out of this tension, so authorities were also kind of hinting foreign hand in this tension. You know we have to take these kind of information with lots of grain of salt. So what's your take on that? And also, given the way this round of tension turned violent, does it make sense?
Foreign fighters, I doubt it. I mean, I seriously doubt it. Kazakhstan, I remember just a few months ago, had problems. The same thing. Those foreign fighters.
I don't know whether what was the exact word, like foreign fighters or foreign hand. What was that? I don't like to misinterpret anything. Salim Jan, what was the exact wording here?
The exact wording was all those events in Khoro were orchestrated by foreign organizations and foreign leaders or something like this, you know. It was not about the participation of foreigners so far, but I am afraid it will be. Very soon we will hear that there were at least Afghans or others. Again, based on unpublished information, I do not want to disclose it because maybe it's not true, but the government is preparing a narration that there was Afghans among those Pamiri people, and they killed the Tajik militaries or something like this, you know.
Yeah, you know, we have seen Tajik authorities' narratives in the past.
Yeah, but
usually
they
bad
named
ones.
They named some leaders of the National Alliance, Alim Sherzamonov and Ulfat Khonum Mamad Shoeva. They mean that through those people, Mamad Shoeva is a civil activist, and they mean that some foreign organizations and some members of the oppositions that, you know, the oppositions based in Europe called in Tajikistan terrorist and extremist organization.
Okay, and that way. So, Bruce, I think, you know, the direction of question little changed after Salim John's explanation here. So the way this event turned up so deadly, how you explain this?
Well, you know, as we've heard, this region has unfortunately kind of a history of tensions for the last 30 years, and certainly for the last 15, there's been a lot of problems going up there. And so, like John mentioned, that this really kind of started with Gulbuddin Ziyabekov being killed last November. And I would mention at this point that they changed the leader of Gorno-Badakhshan right before that happened. And really, he seemed to have kept a lid on it for a while. I don't know how much I can give him credit for having Yadgar Faiz for keeping things calm, but it is interesting that after he left, all of a sudden all these problems started, and Ziyabekov was killed. So already you got the tensions building, and they cut off the internet back then. We knew there was protests in November. The security forces have been there all the time, and I imagine they've even added some people to there. So the people were already kind of on edge, and now they're going after locals, not only the ones that are in Gorno-Badakhshan, but as Salim John could tell you, there's a couple of natives of Gorno-Badakhshan that were in Russia, and they just posted information in support of the people out there in Russia, grabbed them and sent them back to Tajikistan, and they were quickly put on trial and convicted and sentenced. They formed a group called Group 44 that was supposed to negotiate all this. With half of it was from local people, half of it was from the government, if I remember right. And they were supposed to come to some kind of agreement on how this is going to work, and that group just faded away. So this has just been kind of building and building. The people up in that area realize that anytime the government is sending forces like they were along this road, it's bad news for them. Always right before, not surprisingly, the violence is preceded by the government building up security forces and sending new security forces to the area. They've known for months that they wanted to arrest some of these informal local leaders, and they've managed to fend off the authorities. And so this was really just, sadly, something that was almost bound to happen. And really, I kind of blame the government for this. They provoked the people and did everything they could to keep tensions high in the region, and don't seem to have done very much at all to try to come to some kind of compromises with the people so that this, what's happening right now, did not happen.
Earlier we were talking about, Selimjan was talking about, in fact, today it seems to be that the things are calm, at least in the context of like shootings are not anymore happening, but people are collecting dead bodies. And then also there was a hint that, authorities are doing house-to-house search. I mean, maybe we are not hearing the sounds of firing, but even if we can call this calm, it's a bad calm. Bakhtiar, you have relatives on the ground. What is the local feeling today as they are collecting their dead bodies?
I have friends from Womar. I've been to Womar. I have a lot of friends actually from Womar. But I'm from Vanj district, which is nearby the Womar. So we have a very close relationship with the people. Ushans. It's a very nice and very friendly because they're along the road. So when I was a student, there was no car. So we were just going to any house, sleep overnight and go back to our district. So it's just phenomenal people. That's why my heart breaks. It's how these people, unfortunately, we don't have any connection with them. There is no, as I said, this is the information that we get from friends. That I was just talking to one of my friends who is also, happened to be, his wife is actually can't even, she's right now here in DC. I'm going to go and see them in a few minutes. She can't even talk. Some of them were their relatives. This is very alarming because the people of, Rushan, all Vanj and Shugnan are very peaceful people. I mean, and now I see a lot of frustration. I even see the comments. The guy just posed that, he's just going to go and fight and then take up the arm. It's very alarming. Yeah. I don't think this time is going to go well. So I think it's the frustration. It's in the highest level. And I predict that the conflict is going to be prolonged and the government just opened the Pandora box at this point.
So we are talking about the epicenter of this was where it was started was Khorog, right?
They started in May 14th.
Yeah.
There is a Khorog is a capital. The Bar Khorog is a couple of kilometers away from Khorog. That's where the Mamat Bokhirov, that's the last stronghold. There used to be a couple of strongholds around the Khorog. There used to be Bar Khorog, there used to be Upede, there used to be a Plebza, there's going to be a Porshnev. All these has had their own leaders, that some of them joined the United Tajik opposition. They were along the military group of opposition. be doing a lot of logistical for United Tajik Opposition. Mm-hmm. Mainly, this was just because of the Badakhshan province and logistical support they provided during the civil war, the United Tajik Opposition was able to succeed and get close to Tajikistan. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of wounded soldiers that they came in with a lot of food. Mm-hmm. The Badakhshan was supporting them a lot. So I was there. I was a student at that time. I was witnessing how people cared about those militaries and freedom fighters that they were actually playing there. But over the years, all those leaders and commanders were eliminated. So like, you know, in Pozhnev, there was a Vodish. So he was very influential. So he passed away. And then his brother, Yodgor, he's also kind of not that active. So Pozhnev area kind of went down. Then there is the Khlebzawod. The Khlebzawod showed a lot of resistance until 2012, until you know the 2012 situation happened. So Khlebzawod was kind of also put down. And then we have Imom Nazarov, who is from UPD district. So Imom Nazar was a disabled person. He's a former judo guy, and he got shot during the one of the events even at that time. So he was disabled. So they even killed these disabled people at his home when he kind of, you know, put up his guns and start negotiating. So, and we just have only one person who is being a standoff, Mamat Bokhirov, who was relatively, you know, very calm, and he worked for border guards. Very nice. I met him myself personally, very charismatic. So, and that he was only him by himself. It's not only him. There is, even if, let's say, hypothetically, even if they eliminate Mamat Bokhirov, that's not going to change anything. There's going to be more frustration, and that's why my prediction is going to be a long-term contact.
I guess it was a drop of word, maybe. So you mentioned some of them to be freedom fighters. So let's, for the sake of this conversation, let's call them opposition groups there. But also, I mean, we are talking about Khurok here, right? We are
I have to mention these are their freedom because they're independent. They're not opposition. They were not in opposition. These people are from United Tajik Opposition. They called them, but they were fighting for freedom of Tajikistan, for independence.
So in that context,
they're not in opposition. They literally, we lost thousands of people, our relatives, in those fights. We will call them as a freedom fighters.
Okay. Good to put that in context. Now we are talking about Khurok. We are talking about Bar Khurok. And we are also talking about Roshan. Maybe, Salim Jan, this is a question for you. When we compare this latest round of anti-government protests or resistance, whatever we call that, are we seeing this has expanded this time?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah, of course. You know, at the beginning, Bakhtiar is giving very good background of the situation that we have now today. When Badakhshan was a last stronghold of opposition and one of the best place of opposition during the civil war. And after the peace agreement in 1997, Rahmon's government succeeded in eliminating all the leaders who remained from the past in many regions. But Badakhshan remained as it was not, let's say, oppositional play, but still, it was the place what was not destroyed morally, or I don't know. But anyway, so there was a lot of leaders, different type of leaders. Of course, some of them were involved in some criminal activities, others purely making social service, others were helping religious communities and so on. And one by one, they were eliminated from the scene. And Mamat Bokhirov probably is the last one from this list, let's say. And all the time, everything was about him. So at the beginning, let's say when it started in 2012 or a bit earlier, it was just about 30 or 50 persons. Now the government had been doing everything to make all the others stay the same line with Mamat Bokhirov. And it's not only in Khurok, it's in Roshkala when Gulbuddin Ziyobekov was killed during the arrest, and the government, it was not able to investigate it and to punish those who killed him without any cause. Yeah, and it's expanding for sure, because now we have Roshan also. You know, those leaders, as usual, as all the other leaders, will have some supporters, and we have those who dislike them, saying because of them we have troubles. But now a lot of people are understanding that they should unite with those people, with those leaders, and support them, because now we are witnessing hashtag Pravda Sila. It means that the power is in the truth. So yeah, for sure it's expanding, and also the situation is making unhappy a lot of people in other regions, in the north, in the south, among the Tajik migrants in Russia, and in many places. And this sentiment based not only in supporting some informal leader in Badakhshan, but mostly on economic and social problem that people are facing now. You know, the prices are going up every day. The remittances from Russia is reducing due to the Western sanctions against Russia. So a lot of problems, and no new jobs, no employment. So, of course, people are starting to understand that this government, when one man is ruling for 30 years and their lives are not changing, so, of course, this type of protest potential will grow.
Yeah. Just to bring this back into the latest events, you know, it was nicely put, Salim John, the regional scope of resistance is changing, and then actors are expanding, and then it is intensifying. The bottom line is what all this shows is like we are in a dangerous path. So what comes next? What are the likely scenarios in the ongoing reaction by the authorities, tell us, in terms of future direction of things going forward from here? So was it avoidable, and is the future tensions preventable? What needs to happen to return to normalcy? So let's continue the conversation talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Bakhtiyor Safarov, the director of Central Asia Consulting, Salimjan Ayubov, the director of Radio Free Prepared Liberty's Tajik service, locally known as Radio Azadi, and Bruce Panier, the author of Radio Free Prepared Liberty's Central Asia in Focus newsletter. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Prepared Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the ongoing tension in Tajikistan's Gorno-Badakhshan region. So, colleagues, we have spent lots of time discussing the ongoing tension in the region, obviously a very important one, but that also means that we need to wrap up the conversation very soon. With this, I guess my next one or two questions are very simple. Based on what we have seen so far, and especially in the latest tension, where we see the direction of events going from here? Bruce, let me start with you.
You know, sadly, what we're looking at is kind of a repeat of what's going on. Salim John already mentioned that today there seems to be quiet, relatively quiet, you know, and that's what we've had, like these intense but very short periods of violence, usually localized in this, but you know, they kind of go for a couple of days, and then they start negotiating, and they figure out some way to keep a very temporary and fragile truce going on in the area. You know, we, Bakhtiyar and I, were discussing this earlier on a different thing, and I still stick with there's a lot of Western governments and organizations now that are leaning on the Tajik government to wrap this up, you know, to stop this. They're calling for a ceasefire. They're calling on everyone to pull back and everything. Clearly, Tajikistan will have Russian support, and in the past when these things have happened, they've actually had Chinese support also for what they term a security operation. And you were right to mention that Tajik authorities exaggerate what's going on so badly in the past that we're never really sure what's going on for a while. The only thing we are sure of is that the version that the Tajik government's providing is not the truth, and usually not even close to being the truth. But because Russia's bogged down in Ukraine and isn't going to be able to help too much, even with moral support for Tajikistan, and the Western governments looking forward into the future are the only ones that are going to provide financial support, except for maybe the Chinese, and Tajikistan's really in debt to them. So the Western governments have a lot more influence at this particular moment, and if they keep calling for the ceasefire, the Tajik government's going to have to do something, because they're going to be begging these people for money down the road. So they're going to have to do something to cooperate a little bit with the embassies and you know, European Union and stuff, and which is to negotiate. But unfortunately, that solves the problem today. But you know, long-term, it doesn't solve anything at all.
But it looks like, you are saying that European ambassadors, I have seen their statements as well. Yeah, they are calling for negotiations and things like that. But the way Tajik authorities are responding to the realities on the ground today, like with house-to-house searches, I mean, they are not in the negotiation mode. And also, Twitter is not a good place to go for sourcing out information about this kind of situation these days. But, you know, there was also a reference to the either interior minister or deputy interior minister, but the way he was reacting, like, you know, we have to, you know, tackle this with a heavy hand, like, you know, referencing to back to 20 years ago or something. I mean, it just none of those comments, none of those actions looks like they are in the mode of negotiation. So in that context, too, I was just looking into, I mean, really where they are trying to take this conversation after this stage.
Well, you know, I mean, at least in my opinion, it's a no-win for the Tajik government. This is a remote area with people scattered all around, and it's hard to get up there. How are they ever? They've never been able to exert total control over the area. Selimjana and Bakhtiar both were saying over in the course of 30 years, even after the civil war, this is one area of the country that's always been. It's part of Tajikistan, but it's not really under the control of the government. And the best solution they had to the problems was to work out compromises with local leaders and let it go. Every time the Tajik government tries to extend its control or solidify its control over the region, this is what happens, what's happening right now. It doesn't work. It's not sustainable. They can't keep this up forever. Logistically, it's a nightmare to try to get supplies and troops and everything up there because it's way up in the mountains. You can't depend on the weather to bring people in by plane or helicopter all the time. So they're going to have to come up with some solution because they can't. I think militarily, there's no way that they can ever lock down the region so tight that they'd be able to say, you know, it's firmly under control. And that's why, you know, you got to have some compromises in here to do it. And let me just add, because I know I want to let other people talk too, that part of the problem is that the Tajik government, while they claim this is part of Tajikistan, they don't really provide many finances or much infrastructure work on the region. I mean, look at what we got, one road that goes from Dushanbe to Horog, been independent 30 years, right? So they're saying, we don't want you to listen to the local leaders. We want you to listen to the central government. But the central government doesn't do very much for them to begin with. So who are you going to listen to? The guys on the ground that can maybe get you jobs or even if they're illegal jobs, get you money when the Tajik government doesn't provide any money and doesn't build stuff? And I've said on the program before that a lot of the trade between China and Dushanbe that goes on this road is exempted from duties and tariffs and fees when it goes through Gorno-Badakhshan because the trucks that are going through are going to companies that belong to members of Rahman's family. So they don't even get any money off that. So, I mean, it's like a horrible situation where the Tajik government wants them to be loyal, but there's nothing to endear themselves to the people and engender any sense of loyalty. They treat them like an outcast region while insisting that they're part of Tajikistan.
You know, before I got into the studio, I was watching some documentaries that, you know, Western tourists, you know, make those kind of documentaries, immature ones, reflecting the realities on the ground and around those places. I mean, I've seen some villages without electricity in this era. Certainly, there's no investment. Of course, there is a huge room for further investment, obviously, let me put it in that way. And also, Bruce, you were talking about in terms of the compromise being one solution to go forward as I'm trying to conclude the conversation here. I'm also thinking like the tension has grown so much blood has been shed. How can they reach to compromise? What will satisfy authorities? What will satisfy local population there so that future similar events are being prevented? Is there any like one or two suggestions, recommendations you have, Bakhtiar, on that? I mean, what can bring kind of lasting peace to this region?
At this point, what I think is now the people of Gbao and entire Tajikistan opposition is going to go into counteroffensive. What I mean is, for the 30 years, the people were trying to negotiate and come up with a solution, so it didn't work. And now, I think what's going to happen is there is a group of opposition leaders who are in Europe. They form a group called National Alliance of Tajikistan. There are a number of parties. So now what I think that most of the people from Badakhshan are going to join this movement. So it's going to be very strong politically. I think over the years, It's not going to be immediate, but they're going to go into counteroffensive.
How should we imagine that counteroffensive, Bakhtiyar?
Most of the conversation and everything was now private. So now they're going to start speaking up. Mm. More people coming on, you know, do more political work. Like as we speak right now, in more matter of, you know, 24 hours, we have almost 200 to 150 people right now gathering in White House. So there's going to be more people who had to fly to Europe. Mm. So they're going to be more active. So I think at this point it was a breaking point. Mm. And that now we're going to probably hear more good news for people who are really thriving for independence. Mm. And I think it's time now to go back to our agreements and really, really obtain the independence. And this is what most people now saying. So it's time to go counter.
Yeah, very worrying indeed. Salim Jones, as a journalist, we always keep our eyes on indicators to determine what comes next in situations like that. Where your eyes will be, what kind of indicators you will be looking at in terms of what comes next, what might follow after this stage?
It's difficult to predict the situation because we have been witnessing the same kind of situation many times, but today, it's, yeah, of course. Basically, it's a kind of deadlock, and the dilemma is mostly for the government. Mm. Why? Because it should regain or ravine or attract the trust of people of Badakhshan if it wants to keep situation more or less under control. But winning the trust of the people in this situation and with this background and with this history will be not easy, because the government actually has no record of being trustful or having open conversation with the citizens. First of all, to complete the investigation of Gulbiniz Yobekov's killing and punish those who killed him, and then to think about how to give more autonomy to this autonomous region, because the autonomy for Badakhshan is mostly nominal, although the Dushanbe accusing the people of Badakhshan are living on subsidies from the center. On the other hand, most of the profits that the government is making, having the only road for the China to bring its product, its to Tajik market. Mm. It's really, really, really very complicated for the Tajik government to resolve this issue, this problem. However, it could be two kind of scenarios. Mm. First, maybe since the government is used to rely on the power and on a huge power and to resolve problems by power, maybe they will arrest Mohammad Bukhir and others or negotiate with them and he will be surrendered and so on. And then to keep the same kind of situation for next 10 or more years. However, we shouldn't forget that Rahmon is becoming older and he has a plan of the power transfer. Wanted to make his son the head of, or maybe daughter, the head of the country, the ruler of the country. Mm. So it will be difficult for him having this type of Pamir going ahead with his plan. Mm. And that's why I am leaning to the first scenario about the winning trust of the people. We don't know how they will do it, but it's necessary for Rahmon, and it's a question of to be or not to be in charge of the country and having good future. In one word, the situation is very complicated and difficult to predict the future.
It is very unpredictable, obviously, but we are also out of time, but there are many, many more questions that are coming to my mind. I mean, yeah, obviously, one indicator is that, you know, about the possible transition of power in Tajikistan, either that happens from father to son or daughter. I mean, what kind of implication that is going to have to many things, including the situation in Gorno-Badakhshan. Obviously, we will keep our eyes open to that. And I don't like to open up another conversation here after all these bloodshed, you know, growing tension, intensity of that, size and scope of that. I mean, again, one wonders, I mean, whether it's too late to build the type of trust, Selimjan, you were talking about. Obviously, the regional dynamics are also changing. As earlier Bruce said, you know, Russia's occupied in Ukraine, and developments in Afghanistan is not any promising going forward. I mean, the tension around the bordering area is intensifying. There is a lot to look at and keep our eyes on. So we will keep our eyes on, and we will be back into this conversation, hopefully talking about something better, something positive when we come back to it. So today we have to unfortunately conclude the conversation here. So thank you very much, Bakhtiyar Safarov, the Director of Central Asia Consulting. Also big thanks to Selimjan Ayubov, the Director of Radio Free Europe Liberty's Tajik Service, and Bruce Panier, the author of Radio Free Europe Liberty's Central Asia in Focus newsletter. Also, I just want to remind that Bruce is also following these and all the other events in Central Asia in his weekly newsletter, Central Asia in Focus. For more updates, I invite you to subscribe to it and spread the word about it so that it reaches to maximum number of people. So with this, this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.